Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast of Bruegel, the economic affairs think tank in Brussels. I am your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel and columnist for Breaking Views, and I am joined today by fellow senior fellow Nicolas Ferrand and our esteemed guest, Johan van Oefertveld, member of the European Parliament, chairman of the budget committee there, and also former finance minister of Belgium. We are here today to talk about the impact of the sanctions on Russian assets in the global financial system and how that has affected Euroclear, the Brussels-based clearinghouse and depository, and what that means in terms of systemic risk for Belgium, for Europe, for the world, and what we might want to do about it, and also about how all of these frozen assets have generated a lot of money, surprisingly. And that money is also now in question because the world has to come up, or much of the Western world has to come up with ways to help Ukraine that it is supporting in this ending the second year after the full-scale Russian invasion. Nicolas, for people who are new to this topic, can you talk about how it is that Euroclear, this thing in Brussels that many people are unfamiliar with, has ended up at the center of this debate about Russian money and everything else?
Thanks, Rebecca. I would like to say, you know, it's very simple. I'm not sure I will fulfill that promise. But to make a long story short, the Russian Central Bank has foreign reserves. It has assets that it wants to keep outside of Russia. And in the run-up to the Ukraine invasion, actually, they have put more of those assets, not less, into the Eurozone because they anticipated a hostile reaction from the US and from the UK, but less so from the Eurozone. So actually the composition, the currency composition, the location of the Russian assets, to the extent we know from disclosures before the full-scale invasion in early 22, has moved from the dollar zone to the Eurozone, and therefore there are a lot of those assets in the Eurozone. It turns out that the bulk of those assets were held in the form of securities, shares, bonds, sovereign debt, securities. We don't know the exact breakdown, but those securities are held at Euroclear because that's what Euroclear does. Euroclear is a central securities depository. It's actually one of two major international central securities depositories. The other one is Clearstream in Luxembourg, but there were way fewer Russian assets at Clearstream than Euroclear, probably a little bit, but not by an order of magnitude the same amount. At Euroclear, there's about 180 billion euro, according to documents that have filtered from the decision-making process. And these securities gradually come to maturity. So at this point, about more than 130 of that 180 plus have come to maturity. Normally, what happens at Euroclear is when your security held there comes to maturity, you get repaid in cash. So technically, the cash is held at Euroclear Bank and then you withdraw it to put it somewhere else or to put it back into securities held at Euroclear. But because of the sanctions, the Central Bank of Russia cannot do that. And therefore, its cash accumulates at Euroclear Bank. And therefore, the balance sheet of Euroclear Bank has ballooned from less than 30 billion euro before this whole thing started in early 22. Over the years, it was always hovering a bit below, but close to 30 billion euro. Now it's 165 billion euro, more or less, because of this Russian effect. And that's also why all this had to be disclosed, because it was basically impossible for Euroclear to hide. And they had no choice but to disclose in quite a lot of detail the impact of the Russia sanctions on their financials and balance sheet. So that's where we are. There's all this cash and still some securities at Euroclear. One of the debates, of course, is whether this can be appropriated or confiscated by Ukraine's friends for the benefit of Ukraine, but that raises a number of legal questions. And then there are maybe ways to circumvent or, step close to that obstacle, and that's what we want to discuss today.
One of the proposals is that the interest on all of this cash, so not the actual runoff and coupon payments and securities redemptions, but the interest that earns just by sitting in an account could be redirected to Ukraine, and the EU member states have taken steps to lay the legal groundwork to do that later if they want to. However, there are also more ambitious proposals on the table. And Johan, can you maybe tell us first what it has meant for Belgium to have an institution of this magnitude there, and then tell us something about your proposal?
Well, like Mr. Veron already explained, this came quite sudden, this exposure of Euroclear to this geopolitical situation, where the balance sheet grew enormously with everything that entails. That's a new situation for Euroclear. And of course, given, for example, but not the least, cyber risks that are constantly involved in all this, this has been an enormous challenge for the people of Euroclear to make sure that that the institution remained safe. Until now, that has succeeded. They've done a great job, I think, in doing that. But of course, the question then is, what are you going to do with this money? And in order to give a little bit a broader picture of my proposal, let me go back to the decision made 2 weeks ago by the, or is in the making, but will be made, that there will be a Ukraine facility of 50 billion. Now, let's do a little bit of math on that. It's for 4 years. That means, on average, 12.5 billion a year. Now, we all know that a very conservative estimate of the budget needs of the Ukraine state is 3 billion a month, which means, in broad numbers again, 36 billion a year. The US and the EU, in the beginning of the conflict, have taken sworn, between brackets, to each take half of these needs for their accounts, which means then each 18 billion. But this means that with this Ukraine facility of 50 billion, we're already 5.5 billion a year short. And that is under the enormous assumption that the Americans will come through, which with what everything what has been happening, what Mr. Trump has been saying, the problems President Biden had to get the aid package through Congress and Senate and Congress, is of course a huge hypothesis. So the conclusion for me is, we will need more money for Ukraine if we want to stand by our promise to help this country, this democracy, against this violent attack, this brutal attack from Mr. Putin's Russia. And like was already said also by Nicolas, the confiscation of this amount, let's in rounded numbers, 200 billion at Euroclear, has legal, monetary, and geopolitical problems. I don't want to go into the legal problems. The monetary problems are obvious when you see the reaction of the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. They're both against because, of course, they fear the impact on the international status of dollar or euro if something like that is done. And also geopolitical, because if you're any other country in the world and you see this happening, you might ask yourself whether it's safe for you to keep your money, for example, at Euroclear, given that it can be confiscated if something happens. So there are a lot of good reasons not to do it. But I think there's a middle way between doing nothing or just take the interest, which, by the way, is, let's say, something like 7-8 billion, is like a drop on a hot plate given the needs of Ukraine. Why don't we use these, again, let me talk in rounded numbers, these 200 billion as a collateral, where all the countries concerned, EU, Belgium, engage themselves to keep the money on the account, take up a loan in the capital market, of, for example, 150 billion, use the proceeds of the 200 billion to pay the interest on the 150 billion. And then, of course, at one point in time, of course, you need to make sure that the term on which you take out a loan and on which you deposit the money that is actually at Euroclear, that it's the same period, so that you don't get interest surprises. If you do that, then you can cover the interest rates easily, or the interest cost on that loan. And then, of course, the question is, it has to be paid back one time. Well, let that then be part of the final peace negotiations that one day will come. And I think geopolitically, by doing something like that, you might create some leverage on Mr. Putin, Because at the end of the day, you can have the 150 billion available over a long time, because you can make this revolving credit, since you can easily cover the interest cost. That's my proposal. I noticed that there is quite some interest in it from here, but also from across the Atlantic. And I think it might be a way out of this discussion of doing almost nothing, or the rough confiscation, which I think, again, legal, monetary, geopolitical reasons, is not very advisable to do.
Is the basic repayment idea that when the money came back, it would be divided between what would be hopefully a reconstructed Ukraine and possibly friends of Ukraine with foreign aid, and then possibly also by Russia, because you said that this might be a measure?
Well, it's beyond any doubt that Russia has caused a lot of damage in Ukraine, and the Ukraine country has not asked for that damage, to say the least. So if and when you come to a peace process with Russia, at least part of the damage should be paid by Russia, one way or the other. And of course, if we never reach a peace agreement, then I would say all bets are off. Then we'll see where we get. But then we talk in terms of years before we reach that conclusion. So financially, I think it's sound. It's covered. Geopolitically, it might be an incentive for Mr. Putin to come to the negotiating table more quickly. But I may be wrong. I'm open for discussion.
Is there a reason why you think markets might be more likely to buy bonds from this fund than from the EU? Because of this 50 billion EU level Ukraine facility, more than half of that is going to be financed at the EU level.
Yeah, but if the financial sector knows that these funds are blocked, and of course the countries involved, and especially Belgium, need to engage themselves, that as long as there is a loan amount outstanding, that they keep the funds blocked, obviously, then they have no risk. An additional advantage is that in such a situation, the banks that would step forward to provide 150 billion don't need extra capital, because it's fully covered.
And you don't think there would be a risk premium from...
There will be a risk premium, but it will be very small.
But the perception, though, that this collateral could disappear and all of the consequences that you describe, wouldn't that risk premium start getting priced in even?
Yes. Well, but that's one of the cruxes of the whole affair, that the countries, the EU, will have to engage and be firm in its commitment that the funds remain blocked as long as there is an amount outstanding on the loan.
On that point, in a way, there is already a commitment, right? Because the G7 has said that the amounts would remain immobilized until a settlement is found for Ukraine. So they have tied themselves, certainly rhetorically, for that matter. I have a question which complements Rebecca's, which is about Euroclear itself as an institution, as a critical financial infrastructure, also, frankly, as a private sector company. So, of course, Euroclear's shares are held by a variety of shareholders, typically institutional, but they're not listed, so we cannot observe a share price. But how do you think of the viability and the prospects of Euroclear as a profit-making infrastructure in this circumstance where it's becoming increasingly, to put it bluntly, a political football? And what does that mean also in terms of risk scenarios on Euroclear itself? The media have published stories that they are subject to dozens of hostile lawsuits in Russia that they're likely to lose. What is the kind of risk landscape for that company, which is so important in Belgium, as you mentioned?
I think if you look at it from the legal point of view, because this is legal, these are legal issues that you have to settle, and of course corporate legal issues, I think it would be advisable to place these Russian assets in a separate legal entity, and that everybody then engages to keep the sum there as long as there is, I repeat myself, any amount due. Will that have an impact on Euroclear? Of course it will have an impact, because it's a little bit a game changer, because like you said, I would not like to use the word football, but Euroclear becomes engaged in a geopolitical power game. I think that's fair to say. And that's why I would plead for putting this money in a separate legal entity. How that has to be worked out in the ultimate legal details is up to the legal guys who are knowledgeable about this. But I think this is manageable. And let's not forget that we have here a very extraordinary situation with an aggressor who clearly specializes in producing lies, who is taking an attitude that is really threatening. Talk to my colleagues in the European Parliament from the Baltic countries and countries like Poland and Romania. And so you realize then that really something has to be done to keep Ukraine up and running and I would add fighting. That's why I think we have to be very creative. And of course, it will have an impact on Euroclear. It's difficult to pinpoint very exactly. It will have that and that and that effect on the way in which Euroclear operates or will have to operate in the future. But I think we have to be bold. We have to be aware of the risk. We have to try to take them into account as best as possible. But doing nothing is the worst thing we can do at this point in time.
Another question I have is about the international coordination of this. Obviously, Euroclear is by far the largest place where immobilized assets of the Bank of Russia currently live, but there are other such habitats for living assets of the Bank of Russia that have been immobilized by international action. There's a little bit in Switzerland, there's a little bit in the US, there's probably not much in the UK, Canada, Australia. There is an unknown amount in Japan. I don't know if it's significant or not. I'm not aware that Japan has communicated a lot about it. But can you give us a sense of how those different jurisdictions would... And there's Clearstream next door in Luxembourg as well. There are assets in other parts of the EU. How does that get coordinated with your proposal?
Well, you already referred yourself to the G7 engagement taken with respect to these Russian assets. If we now start talking more specifically about how to do it and what to do with it, I think that would be the appropriate platform to have that discussion and to get all the noses in one direction. And you mentioned the UK, you mentioned Japan, you mentioned the United States. They are all members of the G7.
Do you think they would go for the same collateralization concept that you proposed from a Belgian perspective?
Well, if Mr. Trump becomes the new president of the United States, then we will certainly have a problem with respect to that. But if Mr. Biden remains president and if Biden lives by what he says, then I think we can work something out with Japan, with the US and with the UK. Switzerland is, of course, another issue. But I think if the EU, the US, the UK and Japan come together on this, it would be very hard for Switzerland not to follow.
When we come back, we'll talk about this more. So we're talking about immobilized Russian assets and the benefits that they could possibly bring for Ukraine if they could be somehow deployed in some way. And I'm still trying to get my head around how taking them off Euroclear's balance sheet and putting them in a legal entity isn't just confiscating them. So can you walk us through that again?
Well, it's almost like changing from bank account. As a comparison, not entirely correct, of course, but the money is still there. If you confiscate it and start spending that money for budgetary purposes in Ukraine or even for military spending to the benefit of Ukraine, then it's gone. If you use the money as collateral, take out a loan against that collateral and use the loan proceeds to give the same aid to Ukraine, you still have the money there. It's collateralized or it's used as collateral, but there will come a point where you have to talk to the Russians when a peace agreement has to be made about how this is going to be settled, which means that at one point in time, of course, for example, EU countries or the US and the UK and Japan can be held responsible for part of the repayment of this loan.
So this is the right metaphor, right? I have money in my bank account. I ask the bank for a loan. They take my cash as collateral. In that case, the bank has a legal enforceable right to execute the collateral if I don't repay the money and to take my money under their ownership. Here, that means that the EU and other participants, but mainly the EU, just could confiscate and would confiscate if, you know, the nice scenario of a good peace treaty doesn't materialize. So I come back to Rebecca's question. Given the clear reluctance of the EU to confiscate for legal, geopolitical, and monetary reasons, as you reminded us, why would investors in those bonds believe that the EU will be comfortable confiscating if the happy scenario doesn't materialize at the time of repayment deadline?
Because we all want this war to come to an end at one point.
Does Mr. Putin want that?
Well, that's exactly the point of the whole thing. I doubt that very much. And by doing it in the way that I propose, we can put pressure on him, because 150 billion is a lot of money if it's used in the proper way. Then he gets more resistance than he has today. So if we want him to come to the table, Mr. Putin does not understand anything else but power. You don't have to talk diplomatics to Mr. If you show power, if you show initiative, if you show that you can hurt him, then you might have a chance that he comes to the table. But
how does confiscation hurt him more than immobilization? Because in both cases, he lost access to the money. As you say, the impression is that the Russian regime looks for the resources that are available to them in the war with Ukraine. And at this point, these resources, these 300 billion, are not available to Russia. So if you move from immobilization to confiscation, there are a number of very important implications for the EU. But does it really change anything for Russia?
Yes, because if you confiscate, the money is gone. There's no reason why Mr. Putin would still count on the money to eventually get it back or something. If it's confiscated, it's gone. It's no longer usable as a leverage vis-a-vis him or as an instrument to put pressure on him. If you immobilize it and use it as collateral, it is still there. He still has a chance to gain at least partially the money back.
Do you think he counts on it?
Well, I don't know. I can't look into his head. But I'm absolutely sure that if you confiscate it and the money is gone, then you lose a potentially important leverage vis-a-vis him.
The question is really a question of Russia versus Mr. Putin. I mean, I think many people are of the view that Putin doesn't count on that money and doesn't expect it under almost any scenario to be returned to his regime while he's in power. Conversely, if there is an evolution of the Russian regime, and I don't want to go into details of scenarios because there are just too many, but it is conceivable that under changed circumstances in Russia, then this question of Russia getting its assets back, de-immobilization, unfreezing, whatever you want to call it, might become more of a prospect than it is under Putin. If that is true, that means there are maybe incentives for Russia, but not for Putin. How do you deal with that tension?
At this point in time, the money is there, it is blocked, and we could eventually use the proceeds, which is nothing. 6, 7, 8 billion.
Well, I could do something with 6, 7, 8 billion.
Well, me too. But if I have to take care of the Russian army and the paying of pensions in Russia and the paying of healthcare service, it may be good for 2 months or something. Not much more than that. If you start using the money without confiscating it, by the way I propose, then it will be a totally different matter for Mr. Putin, because then this country which he is invading has potentially 150 billion or 175, whatever, as long as interest cost and interest proceeds are covering each other, will be available for spending on military needs or other needs. So it will make the resilience of the Ukraine state much larger than it is today.
So under your proposal, would the interest earnings go in the collateral pot with the principal, or would those be go through whatever other process?
No. Just imagine that you get for we talk about six-month period. You put, again in rounded numbers, these 200 million on a deposit. You earn with the present interest rates 3% on it. Yeah?
So the interest goes to Euroclear and is subject to the current debate.
No, no. The interest that you get on the frozen assets is used to cover the interest burden on the loan that you take up. That's why the amount is lower. so that you're sure that if you have, for example, 5 billion proceeds from the frozen assets, that the interest burden on your loan is 4.5 billion.
Because I come back to this question because Euroclear historically, because it does not like to keep cash around, does not return interest to people who happen to accumulate cash balances there.
That's one of the reasons why you put it in another legal entity, so that you have more, or should I say, more degrees of freedom to do that kind of stuff.
So in that case, at a minimum, the interest would go away from Euroclear, which is a thing that it has in common with these other proposals that we have right now.
Yes. And then you have to, very important is that you the term on which you put a deposit and the term of the loan are exactly the same, because otherwise you might get nasty implications if interest rates start to move.
And who would be paying this interest? A bank?
Well, I would talk to a consortium of banks to put up the 150 billion.
I mean, because that's an interesting question right there. You can't get a certificate of deposit for longer than a certain amount of time. And so if you wanted to make a 20-year loan to Ukraine, it would be hard to get a bank to guarantee.
It has to be much more short-term to be able to move when you have to move, in terms of the peace process that eventually will come.
That's really interesting. It sounds like under your proposal, there's very few scenarios, if any, in which Russia gets the full amount back.
Isn't that reasonable?
It does raise these questions about rule of law and about confidence in the international financial system.
I think in terms of the damage you do when invading a country, you're quite strong on rule of law if you take the assumption that the aggressor has to pay at least some part of the damage he has caused. I don't see any contradiction with rule of law issues there.
I think the critical question here is the existence of a peace settlement, because I think we can certainly see this in your proposal. If there is a peace settlement, it is not unreasonable to believe that the settlement includes damages which are of this order of magnitude. So the more difficult question, I think, going back to Rebecca's interrogation, is what if there is none? And can that be ruled out?
Well, if there is no peace agreement, you can keep, at the end of the day, you can keep this loan deposit scheme, keep it running for eternity.
That reminds me of the debates about Next Generation EU. And I'm personally in favor of rolling out Next Generation EU, but not everybody is.
Yeah, of course, you can use the amounts of the proceed only once. If you, in my example of the 200 billion and the 150 billion, if you use the 150 billion, then it's over. I mean, you cannot take more money.
But you can refinance.
But you can refinance, and you can do that eternally. And given the structure that I outlined, you will always be able to cover the interest burden on the outstanding amount. And that is crucial for financial institutions.
There are two different elements of this that I keep coming back to. One of them is if you're a bank and you're looking to buy one of these bonds, it seems to me that you would demand a premium versus buying a bond straight from the EU, because the Ukraine facility will be, at least in part, financed by financial bonds. That's a pretty straightforward repayment procedure. It comes out of the EU budget, as you well know. So it seems like by doing this, on the one hand, you make this available. On the other hand, you make it available at a higher cost, because I would imagine the markets would demand a premium, and there would be an echo effect from worries about the security of the collateral and the worries about other collateral. As I understand it, one of the concerns about these Euroclear assets in Russia that may be confiscated as a result of all of these legal actions that we know exist, even if we don't know the details on them, is that not only is Euroclear out however many billions it has in custody in Russia somewhere, but also other people start taking their money out of Euroclear. Euroclear would seem to be too big to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Would you not be worried about anything that even some people, including, say, the CEO of Euroclear, because I believe she came out recently and said that your plan would threaten the stability of her institution?
Well, of course, it's new for her, and I know her very well. I had a lot of contact with her when I was Minister of Finance, and I appreciate very much the job she has been doing and still is doing at Euroclear. And of course, I can very well imagine that it's a very uneasy situation for her to look at and to take into account all the consequences, which is very difficult to do in any case, to try to imagine what in this scenario all the consequences will be. But going back to the remarks you made earlier on, of course there will be a risk premium. That's why it's necessary that the amount of the loan is lower than the amount of the assets frozen. That's one of the basic issues of or elements of this proposal, that you always have enough space to cover also for this risk premium. And yeah, I think that's very important. And of course, the legal context of this has to be very well researched and very well defined, and will need very precise wording on a lot of issues. But if the alternative is to sit back and say, well, we're happy with 6 or 7 billion a year of interest on assets, which is also legally something that can be discussed. So it's not that that is totally legally risk-free. Also, in that situation, you need to be very careful about how you do it and what the consequences are, not only for Russia, but also with respect to the attitude of other countries. But I think we're in a situation now where we have to move and we have to do something to keep the country not only on its feet, but to be able to withstand this Russian aggression.
So you just mentioned the legal risks in the European Commission's proposal, which is to take the income revenue from the assets that Euroclear currently makes. And one of the things that the CEO of Euroclear has publicly acknowledged recently is that she is fully aware of the exceptional status of that income and willing to, she has a duty to her shareholders, of course, but she signaled very clearly that she would not fight tooth and nail if the EU was to appropriate that revenue. But there have been criticisms of that proposal. There have been indications that the European Central Bank didn't like that proposal, according to media reports. There's also been a paper from the International Monetary Fund, its Financial Sector Assessment Program, in December, where they used the adjective undue appropriation of European revenue, referring to that proposal. Can you tell us more of why the ECB and apparently the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, are, to say the least, unenthusiastic about the Euroclear income appropriation concept, even so in the analysis, certainly of the European Commission, that doesn't represent confiscation of Russian assets, because their analysis is that this income does not in any assumption belong to Russia?
As you know, I'm not in the board, neither of the ECB nor the IMF, so I have to guess or try to reason about the reasons why they take that attitude. And I think the basic thing for certainly these two institutions is that they are aware of the many risks already present today in the international monetary and financial systems. That's, of course, a whole other discussion, but let's take it for granted that there are a lot of potential hotspots in that monetary and financial system. And by doing something like this, you add an extra element of risk or uncertainty. Absolutely sure. And I'm not denying that it is not an additional element of uncertainty or risk. It is. But again, my point is, we have at this point a geopolitical situation that is potentially very explosive, literally and figuratively, and we should do everything we can to avoid this further explosion. Given the fact that Mr. Putin, I cannot repeat that enough, only understands power, you have to get to situations where you can show him that you have power and that you are willing to use that power to stop him. If he becomes convinced of that element, I think the chances of getting him to the negotiating table are much larger than they are today, because today, let's be honest, he laughs in our face. He laughs in our face. And I want to get to a situation where we can tell Mr. Putin, okay, we're doing things that hurt you, and you can stop that if you come to the negotiating table and we make a deal on how to end this war and how to end this conflict.
We come back, we'll talk about more about this and where we go from here.
You
Johan, one question I've had throughout all of this is, if the West could pay Russia $50 billion or $100 billion for a real peace deal, don't you think they would take it? I realize this is a hypothetical upon a hypothetical, but your proposal implies that Russia will pay some of the costs of reconstruction. And I keep thinking, if money could solve this problem and stop the shooting, maybe it would have happened by now.
Well, I just want to have an additional element of pressure on Putin, something that might entice him to come to the negotiating table and be a reasonable, respectful man, which at this point is not. He's not reasonable and he's not respectful of the rights of Ukraine or European rights in general. And so we have to create leverage to obtain that. And I think my proposal is maybe not a perfect example or item for this, but I'm absolutely convinced that it might help to get a more peace-minded, compromise-minded Mr. Putin around.
So on this, going back to the money that Ukraine needs, right? You said ballpark estimates, they need about 35, 40 billion a year of external financial assistance. Let's say that Europe takes, you know, maybe two-thirds of that. That's what? That 0.2, less than 0.3% of European GDP. It's a very affordable expense for Europe. So then, thinking about this issue of show of resolve and narratives, if we say we're not willing to expand the financial assistance to Ukraine from our own pocket, from our taxpayers' money, beyond what has been decided in the EU facility, is that a show of strength or is that a show of weakness? Wouldn't we be stronger if we just said, you know, if Ukraine needs more money, we're not taking it from the immobilized assets of Russia in a complicated or simple way. We just are willing to pay because this is money well spent. Wouldn't that be a simpler affirmation of resolve?
It would certainly be a more powerful response if the European countries, EU, the member states would say, okay, Ukraine needs, instead of the 50 billion for 4 years, 80 billion, we're going to put up the 80 billion.
Shouldn't we aim at that rather than displace the conversation?
Well, we're talking about this right at the same moment when the European Commission has the new Growth and Stability Pact with everything that is in there in terms of getting to more stable public finances in the member states. And of course, as a former Minister of Finance, I'm very well aware of all the trouble it means if you have to start cutting a budget deficit. If on top of the exercise that will be needed in the coming years to get the deficits more under control and the debt development more under control, you have to put up this kind of money, it will be a hard sell within, for example, the European Council. That's absolutely sure. So at the end of the day, don't forget that in my proposal, there is a very strict, legally binding guarantee of the EU and the member states that they are responsible for the money that is blocked. And they are responsible for the amount to be repaid on the loan. That's the crucial thing.
That sounds like quite the Eurostat exercise. I mean, right now, the Ukraine money that's borrowed by the EU through the facility doesn't really show up on member states' balance sheets except as part of their broad EU budget contributions. This might have to be accounted for differently, particularly if you make the taking of collateral automatic, because that's what thing Nicola brought it up earlier. What your system would do was it would take away the political decision to use the collateral by putting it in the hands of the banking sector and this over time. If we get to a point at the very end where they need to take the collateral, presumably they'd be legally bound to do that.
But you can never have the financial sector, the banking sector, financial institutions in general, to act without the very hard, tough guarantee of member states, of the EU, that for what is still due on the amount taken up in the loan, that they guarantee that. And they guarantee it. They can guarantee it by at one point in time confiscating Russian assets, I don't know, or by paying it, or by coming to a new agreement that suppose that at one point in time there's 50 or 60 billion left, that they make an agreement to pay that back over a period of, say, 5 or 10 years. So there is an engagement. It's not that the member states walk away and the Russian assets do the job. No, no, they keep on being responsible for what is happening through that guarantee.
That's really helpful. And this has been a really interesting conversation. Do you have any final words you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I just launched an idea. I am seeing a lot of reactions to it, which is, of course, very good. And the one thing that is really, for me at this point in time, very crucial is that in the Western world, we must realize that this is a crucial time. Either we stand up, we do what we need to do to defend our system, and I mean system in the broader political, economic, social sense of the world, and then we have to put our money where our mouth is. And I am just very humbly throwing in the discussion a proposal that might help to do this in a way that allows us to act relatively quickly and still being responsible for what is happening.
Some media reports have depicted your idea as a Belgian government's idea. Can you tell us more about that?
I can say that I've been talking about this in the parliament for weeks already, for even before Christmas. And at one point in time, I saw that the Belgian Prime Minister, Mr. De Croo, a good friend of mine from during the time we were together in the government of Mr. Michel, also started talking about this. So I don't know whether he got it from me or from some other source, but I have a background in finance long before I went into politics. So the moment you start thinking about something that can be used as collateral, possibilities open up. That's a financial reaction that is automatic. If somebody who is engaged in finance sees a collateral, he sees a deal to be made. This is complicated, I know, I'm very much aware of, but I think it's something that we really need to look into very carefully. It's politically very difficult, not only because we have something happening across the ocean in a few months' time, also within the EU. But these are times that people who really want to do something have to stand up.
Well, thank you for explaining in such detail. Thank you for coming on our podcast to talk about it. Very timely, very interesting, and it's been a real honor to have you here. Thank you, Johan van Overtveld, member of the European Parliament and chairman of the Budget Committee. Thank you, Nicolas Véran, senior fellow at Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, also senior fellow at Bruegel and columnist for Breaking Views. And we are here at The Sound of Economics. You can find all of our podcasts and other research publications, including Nicolas' wonderful essay on the frozen assets question from December, on our website, bruegel.org. Thanks, and see you next time.